thank you for choosing this ISF Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. My name is Paul Holland, Principal Research Analyst with the ISF. Today I'll be talking about Zero Trust with Lou Senko from Q2. Lou, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. What I'd just like to start with regards to Zero Trust is there seems to have been a real kind of uptick in interest in it. I mean, it's been about for a long time, but certainly in the last kind of, probably 18 months or so, a lot more people seem to be interested. Could you just give us a bit of an idea of why you think that is, please?
Yeah, sure. First of all, Paul, it's great to talk to you this morning. Big fan of ISF. Zero Trust, when we think about how much we spend on securing our environments and securing the data, one of the big problems, if you look over the last 12 months, over 60% of the vulnerabilities exploited were zero day, meaning that by the time we knew we had the problem, there was no patch. So it was already, and there was already an exploit in the wild. So no matter how much we think about what the emerging threat landscape is and how much we try to plan our security roadmap to kind of address future threats, the fact is we don't really know what the next thing is going to be. So preparing for the unprepared, right? Designing to fail is really where Zero Trust comes in.
Yeah, excellent. No, thanks very much. That certainly seems to make sense. Something else that seems to have been ramping up with a bit of interest is we've got two very different kind of technology strategies, ideas out there of Zero Trust and also blockchain. And there seems to be some kind of convergence going on between the two. How they can kind of work together.
Sure. So the way we look at Zero Trust here is more around ZTNA, so Zero Trust Network Access. I don't always control the products I'm hosting. I don't always control the design and development of those products. And so there's a whole Zero Trust methodology around how you design components and software to work within a Zero Trust framework. But I certainly do control the hosting environments that they're delivered from. So I can control how those environments interact with the end user, on my own administration staff, how they interact with those environments, and to make sure that, again, whether you're inside the network or outside the network, it doesn't really matter. I don't trust you, right? And so to be clear, it's really not zero trust. It's more like implicit trust. And based on your access and your role, what we grant you access to, that grant never carries forward an implied access to another thing. You have to re-authenticate and go through that revalidation to that next access. So Zero Trust is kind of this constant validation of who you are and that you're supposed to have access to the thing you're asking for. At the end of the day, though, the data is the thing that we're trying to protect the most. So I can't always, with 100% guarantee, no matter how many traps and re-authentications I put in front of that user, ensure that that is the end point, that is the person that is supposed to be using those logins and credentials, that multi-factor authentication, that all those things can be individually defeated, and maybe someone very good at this defeats them all, right? So I still, at the end of the day, have to plan that these things are going to fail, and the bad guy is still going to get past them. So how do I protect that data, which is what they're after, right? So that's where blockchain comes in. We use a blockchain in a very unique way in that it's really like a secrets database. So if you think about the way the application puts all the data in a database and the application connects to that database through a database driver. So very typical architecture. The thing we do is replace that database driver with the ultra thin technology that pulls out what we consider would be sensitive data fields. So not everything, but just the sensitive data. We pull it out and we replace it with a token. So if you look in the database, no sensitive data, just tokens. Then what it does is it takes that data, encodes it, so converts it to new data, sends it to a management console, it encodes it again for a second time, reverse fragments it, chops it up into little bits, and then passes it to a private blockchain. that private blockchain says, hey, I got these little bits. I'm going to encode it for a third time and then scatter it across multiple blockchains. So if you look in our database, there's no sensitive data, just tokens. And if you can figure out how to get into a blockchain, which is difficult today, I'm assuming someone's going to figure out how to do that in the future. So they get into the blockchain. Well, the real data is not there either. It's been encoded three times, chopped up in bits and scattered. The whole trick with this thing then is obviously when the application needs the data, it pulls the token back up through the driver. The driver causes it to rehydrate. So it reverse encodes it, glues it back together and presents it back to the application. So the real data only exists in memory while the application needs it. It's never stored. And so that is my backstop to everything else, right? No matter all the fancy perimeter defenses I have, all the different ways I make it complicated to get into the environment, and I have things like privileged access management where there's no standing credentials on anything. You have to request it and it's granted to you. You log off, it removes your credentials and it rotates the passwords again. So I have made it very, very difficult for someone who's not who they say they are to get in. But assuming that that's still, there's a new thing that I never thought of that it still gets through. The good news is if you get to the database, there's nothing there to get. And if you can figure out how to hack into a blockchain, fine, there's nothing there to get. The encoding is proprietary. So we use five different pillars for the encoding. We randomize the order of the encoding and we randomize the padding between them. And then we throw the keys in with it. So there's no keys to steal. And there's even if you got the source code of the product, you can see how we do it. But because it's randomized at runtime for every block of data that we do it for, you can't reverse engineer it. So it makes it pretty darn safe. And it lets me sleep at night knowing that, hey, there may be a flaw in our thinking, or maybe there's a new unknown threat that we haven't really designed for. But if it gets to the data, there's nothing to steal. And I think that's how we use blockchain. So blockchain's been very popularized around kind of being this ledger underneath kind of things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And this, you make it public so that people can transact, and it's a system of truth to add some sort of clarity around kind of the craziness that cryptocurrency is. And so the blockchain is kind of this immutable truth of who owns what and who did what with it. That's interesting. And maybe a ledger for financial systems will come into place, and the financial industry will adopt a joint ledger system that will make my life a lot easier. But that's not how we use it. We use it really as a secrets database where we store this kind of triple encoded, chopped up and fragmented blocks of data that we can rehydrate to actually create real data back to the application surface.
I see. So what kind of data is it that's being stored in the blockchain? Is this kind of the user accounts, logon information, that kind of thing? Or is it actually kind of pure data out of your databases?
Well, it's a great question. In fact, it's what we would consider to be PII data. So, it's privacy data that we cannot afford to get out into the wild. So things like social insurance numbers, things like, now we haven't gone all the way to cover all the GDPR angle. So, you know, your IP address now may be considered to be somewhat identifiable to the end user. So we haven't gone quite that far, but we actually control this. So this is we have a governance model where there's actually a council internally here where we review all the database schemas. We determine which fields and columns would be quote, unquote, sensitive. Those go under protection. And then we put that whole thing under a change management policy so that any new changes to the product where we change the database schema, it goes through a reevaluation so that we catch anything new that we're adding to the data. And we do this, obviously we have several product lines. And so this type of technology we call Q2 Trust View is interwoven into all of our products. And so every one of them has a separate kind of, approach to this, in that every database is a little different. The data they store is a little different. And so the governance group that sits above this, that determines what we're going to protect, is pretty active around, how we handle change. You know, our idea here is because we're so secure, we can actually enable faster innovation because we are secure. So I can adopt new technologies. I can try different things. I can experiment a little bit because I have great faith that we are secure. And so we're not trying to slow down change and avoid change. We're trying to actually get really good at change. And being secure allows that, right?
Yeah. Okay. So to me, that sounds like this is kind of the next level of anonymization of data from the way you're describing it. That's how it sounds to me. Is that kind of what you're talking about with the blockchain?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you look in the database, and if you're a DBA who actually has, the rights to, get to that database, there's no sensitive data there. It's replaced by, gobbledygook tokens. And then if you look into the blockchain, it's been encoded three different times. So it's been converted, from one data type to a new data type and then chopped up into bits and then scattered across multiple blockchains. So if you look at a blockchain or if someone steals, data out of a blockchain, you got fragments of converted encoded data. So better than encryption. I think security has for many years really, really relied on encryption to be kind of the protection scheme. And I've been in this field for a long time. And 10 years ago, I think our encryption was pretty good. But today I can crack that encryption with my cell phone, right? So today I would say encryption is pretty good, but someone's going to be able to crack it sooner or later. And the problem with encryption is the source data is still there. It's just covered in math. So if someone gets into your house and steals part of your database, and all you relied on was encryption, they've stolen the source data. Now they can't read it yet, but eventually they will be. And I have to tell you as a vendor that as a customer of mine, hey, your data has been stolen. Now, hopefully they can't read it. This is a completely different model because that data has been converted into new data three different times and chopped up. What they stolen isn't, you can't reverse it. You can't turn it back into real data anymore. So it's not useful. So it gives me an ability to sleep at night knowing that I don't have the sensitive data to leak either accidentally or on purpose. So it gives us a certain amount of comfort that, I have 7 petabytes of data. So 7 with 15 zeros after it. So there's a big rich target there. Should a bad actor get access?
Yeah, absolutely. And with encryption and the concerns about quantum computing, everybody's kind of that opinion that encryption will need to get better.
Right.
Because it's not going to be too long before the quantum computers are fully out there and we'll be able to break God knows what level of encryption.
Right.
That's just definitely a concern. Obviously, the other side of zero trust, then, like you're saying, is this blockchain allows you to kind of do things quicker and just kind of move on. So I suppose it allows you to be more agile because you can just kind of bolt new things into your zero trust environment, can't you? As and when you create something new, it's reasonably easy to just add it into your ZTNA, isn't it?
Right, exactly right. And again, when you think about zero-day issues, you think about as you adopt new technologies and you think you're trained and you think you're following best practice, but you don't know what you don't know. And so, a third of the breaches last year were from an insider. Now, the good news is only half of those were malicious. The other half were accidental. So there was just people doing their jobs and accidentally did something and spilled it, right? And so, I think I have a great team. And I think they're next level technicians that do a fantastic job. But that doesn't mean I put them in a situation where they're prone to accidentally doing something that they didn't know they did? Sure, like anybody, right? Did we accidentally leave a door open? Did we accidentally spill something? Sure. Do we have a zero day we don't know about until an hour from now when the vendor announces there's a zero day and the exploit's already been running around for 2 weeks? Sure. So I can't stop those kind of things. And so the way I prevent that from happening is I just don't have the data to leak. And then that lets me back up and be comfortable. Now, I make that sound simple, but obviously this technology has 26 patents on it, so it's not simple. And the partners that we use to deliver this kind of stuff are specialized in this use case of how to use a blockchain in this way to obfuscate the data from ever being stored. So this isn't something that we've invented. This is something that we use, and it's actually available for any customer to or anybody listening to this podcast can dial it up and play with it and decide whether it's the right thing for their environment.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because zero trust itself is complicated. It's not easy to do. So you add in the kind of the blockchain element as well. And yeah, you're just kind of complicating it further. But having said that, it may be complex. It may be a hard journey. But from what I've seen and the people we've spoken to, it's a journey that's well worth taking. I'm sure you agree with that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing with zero trust is it's not just a technology set, but it's more of an approach, right? It's a framework that we operate in to make sure that, you know, as we buy, and the folks listening to this are probably like me, you wake up every morning and you get five emails from companies you've never heard of trying to sell security tools, and every one of them sound good, but every one of them, these companies didn't exist 3 months ago. So it's hard to figure out which ones you're going to invest in and go through the whole pain of change and deployment and trust when half these companies won't even be around in a year. And so you don't really know what's real anymore. And some of the big tried true names in the past are already obsolete. And so it is some of these new startups that really bring the cool stuff to the table. But again, there's so many of them, it's hard to sort through the fact or the fiction here. So when, you know, zero trust then allows us to really just keep designing that whatever we deploy in our endpoints, do I think we have a really hardened endpoint? I do. But you know what? There's going to be a failure I don't even know about that a bad actor is going to be able to get on there. And whenever you have a human being the user, that they're going to let doors open on you that you never anticipated. So, you know, the endpoint's going to get compromised. Well, okay, then the jump into the corporate network, hey, that's going to happen, even though we've protected that. There's going to be a problem there. And then how they jump off into our SaaS applications or into our hosting environments, that everything has a vulnerability, even if you don't. You just have to know that you have it, even if you don't know what it is. And it's going to get discovered. We bring third parties in every year to test us and to look at our security posture and to recommend, you know, tell us what we're doing well and validate, and then tell us what we could do better. And so we continually are on this journey, but the zero trust is just a way to just believe that you don't know stuff, and you're going to have to design for it to be compromised. And so what are they after, and how do you just have this next layer in front of them that if they get through that, there's another layer, and if you get through that, there's another layer. And at the end of the day, if you've protected the data that makes it unusable, should they get there, then I think you can kick back and relax a little bit that the jewel, you don't have the jewels. What it really did for us is it turned the attack surface back into the application. So the only way the real data exists is when it's the application wants it, it rehydrates it and it's presented back to the application and it's in memory. So it turned the attack surface from this kind of lateral, get into the infrastructure and look around for databases and steal data out the back door. Now you have to really come in the front door and use the application to get the data, because that's the only place it exists. So now it's more about protecting ourselves from fraud than it is from an actual, you know, an attack at the infrastructure layer.
Yeah, that's a very different approach, isn't it? And much harder for someone to try and do something in that respect.
So and we can build software stuff to stop it, right? So it gives me an opportunity to address it at the application layer.
Yeah, absolutely. No, definitely. Lou, I really want to thank you for your time today. That was a really interesting conversation. There's some really good insights in what you said. So thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Oh, it was great spending some time with you. And again, a big fan of ISF.
Thanks very much. And thank you all for listening. Please subscribe to our podcasts wherever you listen to them so as not to miss any future episodes as we release them. To access our catalogue of podcasts and videos, please visit securityforum.org, where you can also access IFSF research, practical tools, and guidance. Thank you.